You ever seen the movie?
One, two. All right, gang, shall we? Since Aaron can't find his proverb, I have to do one this morning. He was looking diligently. Troy says I do a lot about the sluggard, so... Proverbs 13:4. Speaking of... Some of these have an agenda. Some of them don't. This one may. Proverbs 13:4. Mustachelessness. Jordan, will you read that for us? Mustachelessness.
The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. Soul of the diligent is made fat.
All right. The soul of the sluggard, so speaking of sluggards, craves and gets nothing. What does it mean that a sluggard craves? I feel like I've done this one before, but stop me if we've gotten two confirmations we haven't. I've done it in my head at least. As I'm teaching you guys in the middle of the night in my dreams. That's what I dream about, teaching residency. No. What does it mean that the sluggard craves? What do they have if they crave? They have desires, they have wants, they have ambitions, they have aspirations in life, right? They have the same things that, in part B of this proverb, that the diligent has, right? Everybody's got desires, everybody has wants to's, everybody has things that they're dreaming about. So what then is the difference between the soul of the sluggard and the soul of the diligent?
One gets up and does.
One has the ability to convert dreams into reality, and the other doesn't. So one is left with these desires and aspirations in life that may be noble, great things, but they don't have the ability to put shoe leather on them. They don't have the ability to figure out, how do I get from here to there? What's the difference between a dream or an ambition and a daydream? Ultimately, it's a plan, the ability to say, you know what, that's where I want to go. Those are my aspirations and my desires in life. And if that's the case, what is it going to take me to start here and to get there? And the difference between being able to reach that point or not is simply a plan to be able to put in place. If you guys have the ability to see your life 15, 20, 50 years down the road and say, man, that's what I want said of me. When I'm dead and some guy standing at the pulpit doing my funeral, these are the things I want said about me. With my family aspirations and my life there, with my kids, with my professional world, with my walk with God, these are the things I want said about me in my tombstone when I'm dead. You guys ever thought about that? Like, what do you want your life to be about? What are you going to invest in? Is it going to be in things that matter? Is it going to be in things that are not important? And it's not to say that we can't spend our lives and times doing things that are life-giving to us in some degree, but each of you guys have talents and gifts that are given by God. And ultimately, at the end of your life, we're going to look back and say, man, did you do those? And for those of us that have the ability to convert dreams into reality, those are the people that are going to have cravings that are fulfilled. And we're not going to be sluggards. We're going to be the diligent. I say weak because I wrestle with those same desires and plans and aspirations. And sometimes it's hard to put a plan into action and to be disciplined to do it. There's an Old Testament commentator by the name of Robert Dick Wilson. He's one of the best, as I'm told, Old Testament guys there is. And he took this proverb, the teaching behind it, and realized, man, if God is gracious to me, I can live for 60, maybe 70 years, and I'm going to divide the rest of my life into thirds. And as he was a post-college student, he decided he was going to spend 15 years going to grad school and mastering all the Semitic languages, Hebrew, Aramaic. He was going to nail it. He was going to spend 15 years of his life in school learning. In the next 15 years of his life, he was going to devote to the study of the word, and he was going to be an expert on every word, every noun, every verb in the Old Testament. He would study every one of them. And then for the last 15 years of his life, he was going to write, and he was going to write the best commentaries there were on the Old Testament. And today, if you want to know what a verse says, what a word says, in the Old Testament, he is your guy. And that's how he chose to divide up his life. And at the end of his life, he was able to look back and say, 20-whatever, I was able to see the next 45 years of my life, God willing, and that's what I set my aspirations to, and I did it. Okay, so as you guys think about that for you, what is it? What do you aspire to? And I think it's a good reminder for all of us. All of us have cravings, and the difference between those that get them done and those that don't are those that are able to implement a plan and stick to it and be diligent and faithful to it.
Did he get married?
I don't know. I imagine he didn't live in a hole, but yeah, he was able to study.
Like, I was just like,
oh. There you go. Aaron's questions are always the best. I was going to say, did he get married?
I didn't say that this time, though.
No. You didn't say I missed it, man. So I think it's somebody else talking. We don't say that.
Hey, I have a kind of like comment thing on this problem right here. What if the slugger doesn't have the resources as the guy, the other guy that's more fulfillment and within that, like, what if he just doesn't have that resources of that mindset to complete that?
Certainly.
Or to look ahead, or he doesn't have that mentor to help him see ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things in life, I think, that make it harder to certainly accomplish those goals, but, man, if those are from the Lord, then he'll provide a way for it. So I think we can't give up on dreams and aspirations just because we don't have the ability. Man, I didn't have $30,000 to pay for seminary either. I didn't have 100 grand when I decided to launch off the front, right? Like, I had no idea where I was going to get any of that stuff. No idea. And God provided. And to this day, I still don't know how we have a $300,000 a year budget. It makes absolutely no sense. I don't have rich friends. I don't have connections. I don't have, not from Fresno. I don't have those means. But God's been faithful and provided. So, That's a short answer, but, and I know there's probably a lot in that question that obviously can be discussed. But man, I think if those are really what the Lord has, then you got to pursue those and see what happens. So, and we all lack resources to some degree. So, okay. Any other thoughts on that? I don't know if I've told you guys this before, but one of the assignments I had to do when I went through my residency program was a life map, and on one piece of paper. Our professor, our pastor, made us put on the right-hand side of the paper at the end of the timeline, death. And then we had to fill in everything in between. What do you want in the next 5 years? What about the next 10 years? What about the next 20 years? What are your marital goals? What are your family goals? What are your ministry goals? What are your professional goals? What are you want to run an Ironman? Like, what are the things in life that you want to accomplish? Write them down. How old are you going to be? How many books do you want to have read? All these things, and it was the most, like, crippling, frustrating, like, I had to commit to these things, and now they're on paper, right? And it was so difficult, right, to write down. You know what? Yeah, I'd like to read a book a month for the rest of my life. Like, how many books is that? Oh, gosh, like, that's a lot of books. Or I want to be married with kids, or, man, I want to be in these things. And again, that life plan has changed dramatically since I was 22 and wrote it, and now as a 41-year-old, it looks completely different. However, it made me accountable to those things. I had to say them out loud. I had to hand them to someone else, and I've talked about them, and it was hard to do, but man, it put reality in there. Like, okay, if I want to finish grad school in, 2001, then I probably had to start at some point, right? So that's going to take some things leading up to that. I need to find resources. I need to apply. I need to figure out how we're going to do that. So whatever those are for you guys, putting pen to paper can be a very challenging and life-giving and fearful process, but it's good, okay? So think about that as you guys process life, okay? Good reminders for all of us, okay? All right, Judges, shall we? Judges 6, indeed. Our boy Gideon. All right, let me pray for us.
We'll dive in.
God, thanks for today. Thanks for our time. Lord, continue to pray for us to be men and women that are marked by diligence. Lord, would you help us to be just cognizant of the fact that this life is short and the things that we're going to invest our life in matter, God. And it's ultimately the Word of God and the souls of men and women that are going to last. And when we're dead, those are the things that will be around after we are long gone. So God, I pray that we would spend our time making eternal investments and deposits into things that matter. So Lord, as we study your word, would you equip us to do just that? Would you help us as men and women to know your word, that we could lead people to your son, that we could be about the business of reconciliation, of bringing people into right relationship with you. And God, as we look at the stories of men and women of old, times in Israel that were dark, that were difficult, where spiritually, boy, it was dim. God, would you teach us from their lives? Specifically, God, this morning from Gideon and some of these other judges, Lord, would you use them for our edification? We love you and we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, thus far, we have seen a couple judges, right? We are in Seattle, if you will. So someone find a better illustration for me, I'd be glad to use it. But it is dark. It is rainy. We are going to see at the end of today what would really be maybe one of the darkest seasons in Israel's history. It's going to be depressing just to see how quickly they veer off from this desire to serve God and to worship God. They get into the land. God has been faithful. They were successful in Joshua, but boy, it is a downhill kind of spiral. And we've seen the pattern, obviously, in Judges that we've talked about of serving God. There's this desire to worship Him. That gets boring after a while. They're influenced by the countries and the nations around them, people around them. They turn to other gods, the Baals, the Asherah, whoever, Chemosh, Molech. We're going to see them all here today. They worship those gods for a while. God takes his hand off the steering wheel until they hit rock bottom. They cry out to God. God raises up a judge to deliver them from whatever foreign oppressor whose god that they had been worshiping is now oppressed Israel. And then God ultimately delivers them and gives them a season of peace. Okay, so we're in one of those cycles with Gideon. And we see it's the Midianites in chapter 6 that are the current oppressors. The condition, the lay of the land at this point is pretty bad. And when we meet Gideon, where do you guys remember? Where is he when we meet him in chapter 6?
In a winepress.
Yeah, he's in a wine press. Okay, wine press obviously is a area where you would make wine. You'd crush wine grapes with your feet. And where should he have been if this was a normative time doing what he was doing? What was he doing? Threshing wheat, right? It should have been done on a hill. Okay, and he meets this angel of the Lord, the angel of the Lord, who comes to him and calls him in verse 12, "O valiant warrior." We talked about the idea of the potential that God sees in him, the ability to call out something that is not yet apparent, but the angel of the Lord sees it. And Gideon is going to be this frail, fearful guy. He's willing to take a step, right? He's doesn't have a ton of faith, but he's got enough to move forward. And he's willing to do ultimately what God says. There's some conditions on Gideon's end that we'll see here in a minute, but he's an interesting guy. So we pick up there. Again, Israel is in oppression from the Midianites. God is going to use this guy by the name of Gideon to deliver his people from the oppression of the Midianites and some other countries, the Amalekites as well. In 13, after now God has met with him, the angel of the Lord has met with him and calls him, "O valiant warrior." This is now Gideon's response. 6:13.
"Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian."
Isn't that great? Like, hey, you talk about this great God, O angel of the Lord. Look around. Like, we're being oppressed by Midian. I've heard the stories of old, like generations ago when God delivered the people from Egypt. But he ain't here. This is a different time and a different place. He has abandoned us and has given us into the hands of Midian. And to some degree, what Gideon is saying is right. God has abandoned Israel. And we're going to see in a chapter coming that God literally says when the people cry out, "I'm done. Y'all are whining. You've looked to your other gods to deliver you. Why don't you go call on them? Go call on Molech and Chemosh and Baal and Asherah. You want to worship them? Why don't you ask them to deliver you?" That's God's response to the people here coming up. So in some sense, Gideon is right. What's that's maybe the half-right side. What's the problem here with Gideon's theology, if you will? What do you not like about his response to the angel of the Lord?
Wait, sorry, Mike. Which verse are you guys on?
6:13. Yeah, there's a sense of that.
And he would have been at least educated within the context of, if you do this, this is what will happen.
Yeah.
And so he's now saying, "Hey, where are you? Wait, I'm not reading any of what you said, but I'm just going to blame you for what's happening.
There's definitely some finger pointing here. And I think to maybe be half full with Gideon, why does he feel this way?
Well, I also see that he's questioning the power of God almost. Like, God can't get them out of this situation.
Yeah, and I forget how long that oppression is. Let me see if I have a note.
Is it kind of like he's responding at a little
40 years. He judges Israel for 40 years. I forget how long they're in oppression. I'm sorry, Aaron, what did you say?
I was like, is it kind of like he's responding at a, like, little faith?
Yeah, and that's certainly his heart. I think what's most maybe depressing and true of all the judges at this point is there's just a sense of hopelessness. There is no out of this problem that we are in. So it's a bad season, okay? However, God sees this guy's potential, okay? Verse 14, the Lord looked at him and said, go in your strength, deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? So you're going to go and you're going to do this, okay? Verse 15, this is a great response as well. And in typical of the type of people that God loves to use. Jane, pick up there in 15. Manasseh.
Manasseh, and I'm the least of my father's house.
So what does he say?
Not me.
I mean, you can't use me. How come? I'm a nobody. Like, I'm the smallest family in Manasseh, and I'm the youngest in my family. Like, sounds like a king that we're about to meet here in 1 Samuel, right? I'm a nobody, man. I'm the least of the tribe. I'm from Judah, and I'm the youngest of my brothers, and I'm out shepherding sheep, right? This is not the job for me. So God says, no, that's actually the type of people I like to use. But the Lord said to him in verse 16, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man. You're going to rally a nation behind you, and you will defeat Midian. Okay? Now 17, watch what Gideon does.
And he said to him, if now I have found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speaks with me.
All right, so what does Gideon need here? A sign. Talk to me, Joe. Preach. I was feeling it right there. You had something good to say. The Holy Spirit was moving. No? All right. He left the building. I love Gideon, right? He's like, okay, I'm buying it, but man, I need something more, right? You just see the weakness of this guy's faith. Like, he's willing to take a step, but he needs some reassurance. I need to see something more than just this word from you. Like, that's great and all. I'm not a valiant warrior. I'm pressing wheat in a wine press. I need to see. I need to touch. I need something visual, tangible, if you will, to know that this is the case. And he's polite. Please do not depart from here until I come back to you in verse 18. Bring my offering and lay it before you. And the angel of the Lord says, I'll remain here until you return. So Gideon literally goes inside, prepares a young goat in verse 19, like makes lunch. Takes his unleavened bread, an ephah of flour, meat, and in the basket. I mean, how long did this take, right? Broth in a pot, brought them out. Like, good gracious, man. He makes this, like, six-course meal while the angel of the Lord's kind of out there just waiting for him. But he's patient with Gideon. He's like, okay, man, you're willing. You just have weak faith, right? It's not ultimately the strength of your faith that matters. It's the strength of what your faith is in that ultimately is going to make the difference. And obviously Gideon has got his faith in the right person. So, verse 20, he brings it back. Tiana, pick up there. That's all right. Derek, bring it.
The angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on his rock, and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat of the unleavened bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared.
How about that? So I'll tell you what you can do with your offering. You want to make an offering? Put it here on the rock, pour out this concoction on top of it, and watch what I'll do. And literally, the angel of the Lord sets it on fire like a burnt offering, right? Touched it with the end of his hand. The staff which is in his hand. And fire sprang up from the rock, consumes the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. Can you imagine, like, what Gideon is doing after all that's done? Like, just mouth agape, like drooling. What just happened, right? So he asked for confirmation. And what did he get? He got confirmation, like, I am who I say I am, okay? So rise up, you're going to defeat Midian as one man. So Gideon gets what he asked for. Now, you're going to see that Gideon's faith is still weak. And what I love about Gideon, that's one of the marks of him. He's not this courageous Mel Gibson, Braveheart, right? Pick whatever hero that you think of in your head that's going to deliver a nation. That's not Gideon. He is frail, he's weak, he's scared. And I think that's so much more of a better picture of how maybe you and I are, right? We're scared. Like, God, can you really use me? Why are you picking me? What about all these other people that are more capable or bigger, stronger, tougher, faster, smarter, whatever the reason is? And yet God says, no, I want to use you. Gideon says, man, okay, if you're sure, I'll give it a go. So he's going to take now the first step of obedience, and that's all he needs to do. And this may be, honestly, the hardest thing that Gideon ever has to do in his life. This is pretty significant. Okay, 22, let's pick up there.
When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace, do not be afraid. You are not going to die."
And it's funny to me, that's always the response. They fear death, and God says, "You're not going to die." So just the being the holiness of God, right? That's just a whole different topic for a different day, but that's always the response. So watch what 24 and 25 he does. Keep rolling, Derek.
So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it "The Lord is Peace." To this day it stands in Ophrah of the Abizarites.
You got it. Okay, so starts with an altar, place of remembrance, what God has done. So he rewrites it down in his diary, if you will, that this is God's faithfulness today. And then what does he do? That same night, so he doesn't waste any time, it came about that the Lord said to him, "Take your father's bull, a second bull 7 years old, pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Ashtoreth that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord, your God, on top of the stronghold, in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Ashtoreth, which you shall cut down." What does God command him to do?
Desecrate the idol,
right? So you've got the altar to Baal, which we've talked about before, and then he says to cut down the Ashtoreth, or the Ashtoreth pole. Okay, this would have been how they worshiped this female goddess, Ashtoreth, Baal's mom. Okay, so two gods of the day.
Is that like a big totem pole?
Think kind of like totem pole, yeah. So it had some type of maybe carved figure or whatever, but it's some type of physical pole that they would worship. That was the instrument of worship for her. So an altar and a pole. Where are these things? Joe? His dad's house. These are in his backyard. Okay, what does that tell you about Gideon's family? They're idol worshipers, right? And not just a little, right? They don't just like casually attend the idol worshiping service. They're the house that people come to worship at. In his backyard, it's an altar to Baal and a pole where you would worship Ashtoreth. And what does God say? Man, if you're going to go save the entire nation from bondage of the Midianites, where are you going to start?
At your house.
Any of you guys ever had like a conversion experience? And your family weren't believers, and you had to go home and have the conversation with your folks, "Hey, I put my faith in Christ," and you had to have that conversation with them. Is that anybody's experience in here? Nobody? Julian, what was that like?
Like, honestly?
Yeah.
It ended in, like, screaming.
Yeah.
It was kind of ridiculous. And the conversation actually ended with my mom saying, "I know where my identity lies," which was pretty cool. But my mom's that kind of person where she suppresses it because, like, she also doesn't want family knowing.
Yeah.
It's such a frowned upon thing. It's kind of ridiculous.
Private, right? I came to Christ when I was 18 in college. Our family was kind of that Christmas Easter crowd. So we had, like, donned the doors of a church, but that was about it. So my parents would have told you they were Christians. We just maybe weren't atheists. That was about the extent of it. But there was no faith. There was no relationship with Jesus. I came home after a semester or two in college, too, I guess, and was in a fraternity, and all of a sudden got involved in Campus Crusade for Christ, and God shared the gospel with me, and God just literally melted my heart. I put my faith in Christ and came home later on to tell my parents that this young 18-year-old zealous, wet behind the ear kit. You know, I got my four spiritual laws track in front of me that I'm walking my parents through. You know, you can know today. You know, I'm literally teaching them the gospel. And my parents are like, what the heck? We sent our kid away for 6 months and he is a nut job. Literally. Call Campus Crusade for Christ or call in connections that they have. Is this a cult? Like, the whole David Koresh Waco thing was just a few years prior to that. So they're thinking, our kid went to college and got involved in a cult, right? So behind the scenes, they're like, okay, that's good, Mike. Good for you, you know, like, weirdo. But externally supportive, but internally they are wigging out thinking, what happened to our kid, right? And come to find out, my mom had some connections with people that were like, no, Campus Crusade's normal. You know, they're not drinking juice and, you know, that could be some, like, mass suicide coming or whatever, right? All these weird cults that are out there. But, man, the initial response from my parents was not positive. It was very much a, say what? Like, where are you coming from? So Gideon, I think, is called to start in his backyard, right? There's no harder place to go home or to go share the gospel or to talk about your faith than home. Your parents know your junk. They know your history. They wiped your backside. I mean, they know everything about you, and yet you've got to go and make a stance for the Lord in this place. And I think it's a great reminder. If you can't do it at home, then you have not earned the right to do it anywhere else, right? If you can't talk to your parents, your brother, your sister, the folks that matter to you the most with your own junk, with your own issues, knowing all that, then you haven't earned the right to go save a nation, if you will. And God makes Gideon start in his own backyard. It's a great reminder to all of us, okay? You talk about like a great sermon for junior hires and high schoolers. Like, man, if you can't live out your faith in home, if you can't respect your parents, if you can't clean up your dishes, if you can't be responsible, and if you can't demonstrate life change at home where something is happening in your life with the way you speak, the way you act, the way you are as a friend, the way you handle your parents, the way you serve your younger brother and sister that you don't like, that you now are loving them unconditionally. If they can't see life change in your home, then don't even bother going outside your house and flying over to Costa Rica and sharing the gospel. Like, do it at home first. Okay, this is where it matters. So Gideon's called to do that. And what I love about Gideon, he obeys, but watch this, okay? Alex, pick up there in 27.
And Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken him. And because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night.
Isn't that just like gut level honest? Like, I'm not doing it during the day. I don't want people to see me do this. I'll do it at 2 a.m. with 10 of my buddies, right? Like, that's an honest assessment. Like, I'm fearful of my life. Like, he sounds like he's kind of big, but I don't know that he's big enough to protect me in the middle of the day from these men, so I'll do it at night. And God's like, okay. Like, you lack faith? That's okay. The object of your faith, you've got placed in the right direction. However, he lacks, and he does it. So he tears it all down. Verse 28, watch how God shows up. This is pretty cool.
When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down, and the Asherah which was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built.
Now, I mean, that's time, that's money, that's your bull. I mean, that's a lot of, like, someone came in and just wrecked everything in your house, you were going to be fairly upset. In 29, they certainly are.
They said to one another, who did this thing? And when they searched about and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, did this thing.
Now, why did he do it at night? So nobody would know, right? And what happens? They asked like two questions. Who did it? Gideon. Like, oh, man, he sold me out, right? So the whole point of him doing this was to be anonymous, and yet immediately they know it's him. Not the 10 guys that are with him, it's Gideon, okay? Verse 10, or 30 rather. Alex, keep going.
When the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah, which was beside it.
So they tell his pops, Joash, hey, bring out your son, we're going to kill him, okay? Who is Joash again? His dad, and what's he been doing this whole time? Worshipping idols, right? He is the Baal, Asherah, pole, altar maker, and worshiper in their backyard, right? This is fascinating. Watch what he says. 31, keep rolling.
But Joash said to all who stood against him, will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar.
All right, Alex, put that in the Living Bible for me. What does Joash say to these men who want to kill Gideon?
Baal is so real, he could fight his own battle.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
It's a great response. So what are you stuck with? You say, well, no, he can't. Well, then you're admitting that you're putting your hopes and faith in this really small God. And if you say, yes, he can, then you realize, okay, I'm admitting that he's big, but now he's not going to do anything to Gideon. So Joash's response is a father first, the gods that I worship second. He looks out for his son, which is fantastic, and it's his idol-worshipping father that ends up saving his life. And the logic makes sense. So the guy's like, okay, therefore, verse 32, on that day he named him Jerubbaal, that is Gideon. That is to say, let Baal contend against him because he had torn down his altar. So the men of the city seem to say, you know what? That makes sense. And we're going to see now Gideon's name change, which is kind of awful, Jerubbaal. Okay, so his name literally means let Baal fight his own battles. Let Baal contend for Baal, if you will. So we'll see that name kind of go back and forth between Jerubbaal and Gideon in the rest of our text. Okay, so he does his job, does it at night. He's fearful. And tons of good nuggets in this guy's life, this young, scared kid, but he gets it done, and God protects him by all means through his idol-worshipping father, and God saves his life, okay? Now that he's done that, he's got some renewed courage. 33, somebody pick up there.
Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and other...
Okay, so all the folks on the east side of the Jordan River, the Midianites and the Amalekites specifically, come over and they're ready to fight a battle with Israel. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. He blew a trumpet, and all the Abizrites came and followed him. So his family comes now to fight with him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh. They also answered the call to follow him. He sent messengers to... In 35, Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, and they came to meet him as well. So he gets the word out. Hey, the Midianites are coming, the Amalekites are coming, we need to fight, and these guys rally with him. Okay, verse 36, Gideon said to God, if you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece, and it is dry around the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken. So what does Gideon now ask for? Another sign, right? He got to see an altar that he made get set on fire at the very word of the angel of the Lord, and goes, okay, that's legit. And he takes a step forward, and he builds or tears down the altar of Baal and Asherah. God delivers him through the hand of his dad. But now what does he need? Further confirmation, right? More external signs, right? Don't you love Gideon? I mean, that's just raw honesty. Don't we get there in our life all the time? Yeah, God, I know what you've done in the past, but man, this is a new day and a new problem, and I'm not really sure if you're real. I'm not sure you're going to show up. So Gideon's just like, please be gracious with me, but I need yet a second sign. And what does God do? Read verse 38.
So he
asked for dew to be in the fleece and not on the grass. What did he get? Dew in the fleece and not on the grass. And he wrung it out, and there was enough to fill a bowl full of water. So quite a bit of dew. And then he went, oh, wait a second. Maybe I asked for the wrong miracle. Maybe I should have asked for the dew to be dry and the grass to be wet. And he says to God in verse 39, don't let your anger burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let me now be it be dry only on the fleece, and let the dew be on the ground be wet. Like, okay, Gideon. And God's just like, you can just see him smiling and shaking his head. God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, and dew was on the ground. Three signs he gets from God. God's patient. He doesn't get frustrated with Gideon. He recognizes that his faith is small. And reassures him, right? Prods him along and realizes, man, that's what he needs. So Gideon is a great example, I think, of all of us who, man, we lack faith. We lack trust that God's going to do and hold up his side of the bargain when we've come to the end of our own means, right? And God's going to show up to do that. Aaron, similar to your question this morning, right? What happens when we lack the means? What happens if we don't have the resources necessary to accomplish the things that God's called us to do? Well, you say, Lord, you're going to have to show up here. I'm at the end of my rope. And if you don't move, I'm going to look pretty stupid. So here we go. These two things are confirmation enough to allow Gideon to move forward. Okay? Now, chapter 7, now that we've dealt with the backyard, now we're going to go to the nation. Yeah, Tessa.
How would you, I guess, like, when you're reading that, and then when you line that up with what Jesus says, don't put your word of God to the test, is this just, like, a diff- because this is, like, pre-Christ? Like, you're, it's like, he's doing that, I mean, he's putting God to the test.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah, I don't know if we can call that and call God to do that every time that we're in pinches like that, you know, to God show your visible hand of a miracle. That's obviously not necessarily gonna be the case. I'm okay with what he does here. Joseph, you got a thought?
I think the intention of where Jesus is tempted and he says, hey, throw yourself off the cliff, or it's been instructed, blah, blah, blah.
Hmm.
And so now you're testing the scripture versus, I think here, he was coming to him with a humble heart,
hmm.
saying, you know, don't be mad at me, you know, give me a sign, this would be the sign. And then it was like an offering. It wasn't like, hey, if I throw myself off this cliff, then you're going to save me. And because you said I wouldn't die,
hmm.
so I'm going to throw myself off this cliff, and I'm not going to die. It's like, yeah, you're not going to die, but I'm going to break both your legs, your arms, and your shoulders, and you're going to have a really rough day. Like, yeah, you know, so I don't think it was more of like a test in that sense, so much as it was an offering of a sign. That's my opinion.
I like it. Yeah. Yeah, be careful putting God to the test with stuff like this moving forward, right? I don't know how to interpret that. I certainly don't. I've asked God for great stuff, and he hasn't always come through on. Send me an email, God. Nothing, right? Just be clear. Something, right? Write something in the sky. Nope. But I think the heart behind Gideon and what we see with the Lord is he's patient and he's gracious with him in his doubt. So whether that's us in the Lord and just expressing our doubt and lack of faith to move forward and whatever it is he's calling us to do, he's gracious with that, which I think is maybe the bigger point. So with that, 7 verse 1, let's pick up there. Tessa, go for it.
Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Harod. And the camp of Midian was north of them, by the hill of Moreh in the valley.
All right, this is one of the few places I can show you in the text, like, I stood right there in Israel at the foot of this battleground, right at the spring. Sean was with us. Tessa, did you go to the Harod Spring when you went to Israel? It's also today like this, it's like a gigantic water park, a natural water park in Israel. So,
oh, wait, was there like the little fishies?
Uh-huh. Like, that ate your fish? Like, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. So like Israelis, when they go on vacation for the day, like they all go down to this gigantic spring that comes out of the ground, right? And they all swim and whatever, and there's all these like cool, I don't know, like little caves you can go swim into. It's a cool little place. But it's all natural, right? So they go swim there and hang out. But this is where Gideon took his army to go fight. Okay, so they are assembled at the Harod Spring. Midian is on the north side of them on the hill. And they are waiting now to go into battle. And they get instructions from the Lord now in verse 2.
The Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their land. Lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.
So Gideon calls all the troops out, right, all these tribes, and says, come rally to me, we're going to fight. This is kind of the funny side of God. Like, if you lack faith, I'm going to put your faith to the test, right? And we find out that 32,000 people come to Gideon. 32,000 men come to fight, okay? And then God says, too many. And the problem is, if 32,000 people go fight, then you guys are going to get the honor and not me. People are going to think that you delivered Israel, 32,000 men, and not me. So Gideon, get rid of some of your men. So he says to you, anybody who's afraid and trembling, let them go home. 22,000 people return. Two-thirds of his army leave. 10,000 remain. So literally, that's moving backwards. That's not what you want as a general. So Gideon has just winnowed his army down from 32,000 now to 10,000 people. And God says in verse 4, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Okay, so God says, We're going to whittle down this 10,000 all the way down maybe to, we're going to find out in verse 6, 300 people. 1% of what came initially is going to remain, less than 1%, okay?
And
so yeah, this is literally the original 300. So see, they stole the idea from the Bible. Dirty dogs. Now, he gives this fascinating description of how we're going to whittle 10,000 down to ultimately to 300. Verse 5, this is God's plan. They're going to go down to the river. And Kyle, this is what they're going to do in verse 5.
So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set by him. You shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink."
Okay, so we're going to separate two groups of people. Okay, one group is how a dog laps water. How does a dog drink water? You guys have dogs.
With his mouth.
Yeah, so you stick your face in the water and you drink it like a dog, right? Right? And if you're a warrior, why would that be bad? You can't see anything. Your head's in the water, okay? Now, the other side is everyone who kneels to drink. Maybe what's implied there? Yeah, potentially bringing your hand to the water. So there's two pictures here. Some suggest that those that drink like a dog are putting their face in the water. And that God is taking everybody who's not prepared, the weaker of the group, and removing them and keeping only the ones that drink maybe with their hand in their mouth. The idea is they're ready to fight and they're looking around and drinking with their hand in their mouth, okay? So at the very least, or what we, at least we know, verse 6, the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. The rest of the people kneeled down to drink water. Okay, it may have been that God keeps the ones that are completely unaware. And the people that kneel to drink, he's like, "No, you guys are too strong. You're bringing your hands to your mouth. You're too good. Y'all go home." And the rest of you to suck your face in the water. So there's confusion on which maybe group God took or what the test was specifically. It doesn't necessarily matter. What matters is we have 300 dudes left to fight. And we started with 32,000. This is not what Gideon wanted. So Gideon, you want your faith tested? Let's go ahead and test it. You want some signs? I'll show you a sign, okay? Can we win this with 32,000? Yeah, but that'd be too easy. Let's stack the deck against God, as he loves to do, and let's go put 300 men against the thousands of men from Midian and Moab that are pressing them right now, or the Midianites and the Amalekites, okay? Verse 8. 300 men took their provisions, their trumpets in their hands, and Gideon sent to all the other men of Israel home, east of their camp. And now the 300 that are left are going to go to Midian, and they're going to go fight this battle. Okay, now verse 9, yet again, Gideon needs a sign. Somebody pick up there, 7-9.
That same night the Lord said to Gideon, "Arise, go down against their camp, for I have given it into your hands."
Past tense, it's done. I'm giving them into your hands. God says it's finished, okay? But, verse 10, God knows Gideon, if you're afraid to go, go with Purah, the servant, your servant, go down to the camp. So what does he do? Verse 11, he goes with Purah and goes down to the camp because he's scared. So God says, "Man, I've already given him into your hand, but if you need reassurance, go with your boy Purah, and I'm going to give you yet another sign." Now, verse 12, here's what they find out.
"Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. And their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore."
That's bad. That is not what you want, right? This is literally like one of those scenes out of the movie 300 where you see their army coming. You're like, they don't ever stop. The ships just keep coming in. They're lining up on the... I mean, they're everywhere, and they've got 300. This is... I just want to go watch that movie, right? It is a bad day if you're Gideon, okay? Gideon came, and behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. So they sneak in, he and Purah, and they're now listening in to this conversation that's happening in the Midianite camp. And the guy says, "I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so as it fell, and it turned it upside down so the tent lay flat." And his friend replied, This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian into the camp, all of the camp, into his hand. So this weak barley bread, right, rolls into the camp and destroys the entire camp of Midian. This was the dream that this Midianite had that he's relaying to his friend that Gideon now overhears. And he says, man, this, his buddy says, this is from the Lord. That's exactly how this is going down. Gideon, you're the loaf of bread. Like, that's the best illustration that we have of you. You're a loaf of bread, right? But that's how this scene's going to go down.
Wait,
so
Pura responded, or the friend that the dude was talking, which friend?
Pura is his buddy that is able to interpret this dream for him. Verse 14, his friend replied, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon. So he hears this conversation as well and says, man, this is what God's talking about. This is from the Lord. These two chumps that are talking in the camp about the bread rolling through, Pura says, I'm going to interpret that. That's you, Gideon. Make sense?
Okay.
Kinda.
Well, it says Gideon arrived, and a man was telling a friend his dream.
So those two guys are the Midianites.
And then in 14 it says his friend responded.
His friend is Pura. His friend, Gideon's friend. That's my take. It could be wrong. But that's why I've taught it for 13 years, so I'm going to stick with it. Came about that Gideon, verse 15, heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, that he bowed down in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into our hands. Now watch how he uses what could have been a disadvantage now as a strength in verse 16.
He divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them. Torches inside the pitchers.
All right, so he divides each into 100, right? This group of 300 now into three groups of 100. And he takes pitchers into the hand. What would a pitcher have been made out of?
Clay,
some type of pottery, right? So every man gets some type of clay jar, and in them a torch, okay? He said to them, verse 17, look at me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. What do you notice is growing in Gideon? Yeah, there's a confidence, there's a leadership, not an arrogance, but a sense of watch me, and as I roll into the camp, follow me, right? So this young, scared, pressing wheat in a wine press man that we met two chapters ago, man, his faith seems to be growing. His confidence in what God is doing through him is moving forward. Neat guy. When I, in verse 18, and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon, verse 19, and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp. They had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets. They smashed the pitchers that were in their hands, which would do what? Why would they smash these pitchers? It's loud. So you've got glass breaking or these pottery jars breaking in three different camps, so they're making a ton of noise. What are they trying to do to the Midianites? They're making them think that there's actually 32,000, which they had, but now there's only 300. But they're trying to make them seem bigger than they are. They're trying to get the Midianites now to freak out. Okay, verse 20, keep rolling.
When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands from blowing, and cried, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon.
So they made all this noise. Now it's nighttime, so they can't really see how many people there are. They're all holding torches. They look bigger than they are, right? And they roll now through the camp, following Gideon's lead. Verse 21, keep rolling.
He stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying out as they fled.
22, how do they beat this army?
When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army.
How about that? So how does the Midianite army go down? They kill one another, right? Gideon's army is just like, they just put on the show. They're just a display. And these guys are so panicked, thinking they're getting invaded by some gigantic Israeli army, that they kill each other. Why God just says, you know, literally, Gideon, watch. Watch what I can do, right? Really, really cool. So you just got to think that Gideon's faith just continues to grow and grow and grow as he watches God work with the least and the last and outnumbered, and that Again, that so tends to be how God wants to do things. All through the Old Testament, the least and the last, the unlikelies. And this is just yet another story of how God is faithful in the midst of their small number. Okay, the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali to Asher and Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. So now more people rally now to the gathering. 24. Gideon now sends messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim and says, come against me and take the waters before them as far as Beth-barah in the Jordan. So they are pushing now Midian back over to the east side of the Jordan. He calls on Ephraim, one of the tribes that's on the other side of the Jordan River, to come help them now do battle now that they're on the other side of the Jordan. Okay, so they summon the men of Ephraim. They come, and in 25, the Ephraimites now capture the two leaders of Midian. Okay, Oreb and Zeb are these guys' names. And the Midianites, these two leaders, are killed by the Ephraimites on the rock of Oreb. So these guys die because now Ephraim has been summoned to work with Gideon. Okay, 8 verse 1, though, these Ephraimites have a problem. What is it? 8:1, read that.
Then the men of Ephraim said to him, what is this thing that you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against me? And they contended with him vigorously.
Hmm. So what are they frustrated about? Yeah, what did Gideon apparently not do? He didn't pick up the phone and call him and say, hey, we're going to battle, why don't you come with me? Gideon picked the people in his area. He's from Manasseh, so he calls the people around him, Dan and Naphtali, the people that are around, and they come and fight. But he doesn't call the people on the other side of the river. And they're saying, hey, what the heck? And they're mad, they're contending with him, okay? Now tell me if this doesn't remind you of a great proverb, verse 2. These guys are hot mad at Gideon. They're calling him to an account. And I would imagine there's voices raised. This is a frustrating deal. They're mad that Gideon hasn't been faithful to call them to battle. Okay? Verse 2, watch what Gideon does.
He said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer?
What does that mean? Verse 3, keep reading and see if you can interpret what he's saying about that. The gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezerite. Gideon's an Abiezerite. So he's saying, isn't the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim, what you guys have done, or your gleaning, bringing them in, better than the vintage, the actual wine of Abiezer, of me? Okay, keep rolling in 3.
God has given
Okay, pause right there. What's Gideon's, what is his strategy moving forward when these guys get in his face and thump his chest and say, what the heck, why didn't you call us?
Gideon's saying that we're weaker than you guys, like you guys is, because mine says grapes, he says, isn't you guys' grapes better than he says, aren't you guys better than the full grapes of the harvest that's not done yet?
So what's a gleaning from a harvest?
Leftovers.
That's when you bring everything in, right? That's the initial portion of the harvest, so the leftovers, right? Ruth and whatever, we've seen that the picture of gleaning. What is the vintage of Abiezer? What is vintage when you think that word? Grapes, vintage, wine. That's the end process, right? So he's comparing himself, saying, listen, the beginnings of what you're bringing in, your grapes, are better than my vintage wine, right? Saying, think about what your vintage is going to be. The idea of, he's saying, man, what you guys have done is so much greater than what I have done. What was I able to do, verse 3, in comparison with you? What would the temptation be at this point when you're Gideon, you've been scared to death to move forward, you've lacked faith, and God shows up in an insanely miraculous way and delivers the Midianite army into your hand with 300 people, and you are the guy in charge of it. What would you do at that point?
I'm better than y'all.
Look at me, right? And Gideon says, who am I in comparison with you? You guys have Oreb and Zeb. You captured the leaders of the Midianite army. What is he doing? He's humbling himself and diffusing their anger. Because he's giving the glory to them. So, man, you guys came in the right time and the right place, and you showed up when I called you. You guys can have your name in the paper. I don't care, right? Watch what this does. End of verse 3.
Then toward him subsided when he said that.
You guys remember that proverb, Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath. That's what Gideon's able to do. In that moment, he doesn't respond with a lobbed volley back to him, right? He gets an angry initial response, but he doesn't feel the need to respond in kind. He says, you know what? I don't need to do that. I'm not going to return anger for anger. I'm going to uplift you guys. And he pours water on a fire as opposed to pouring gas on a fire and making it worse. He puts it out. And these guys are like, yeah, we are kind of a big deal, aren't we? Thanks for noticing, Gideon, right? And he's like, yep, that's fine. Like, I don't need the credit. I don't need to be famous. I don't need to be, you know, it's all good. So beautiful picture of the plus side of Gideon's humility, right? We see his lack of faith. It portions of the story, but yet we see here this desire to credit someone else. Now, this quality in him, this humility in him, is going to pay huge dividends at the end of this chapter, okay? Because he's going to get offered something that would have been really, really hard to turn down, okay? By the way, maybe another angle of the story. What are you seeing happening between the west side tribes and the east side tribes? Yeah, there's a lack of unity, right? We're seeing that division. We're seeing that geographical division occur. So when Gideon thinks about the normal people to call, he doesn't call, right? The folks on the east side of the track, man, they're different. They're other than him. So over generations now, this natural divide is becoming a problem. And it's going to become more of a problem as we continue to journey through Judges. But this initial tension is already seen, okay? The Ephraimites want to be associated with the people on the west side of the Jordan, and they seem to be not included, okay? And they're frustrated with that. Verse 4, this is my theme verse in seminary.
Then Gideon and his 300 men with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary but pursuing.
Weary yet pursuing. You guys ever felt that way in life? Some of you guys probably feel that way right now. Like, I know this is the right thing. I'm dog tired, but I need to put my head down and I need to finish. And I just need to keep pursuing. There will be a day of rest in front of me. I know it's coming, but right now it kind of sucks, right? And it's just, I got to keep going, right? God's called me to put my hand to the plow, not turn around and look behind me. I need to finish this row, and then there will be rest, Lord willing, right? So if you're there, push on. Gideon's been there. He just won a battle. It's a big deal. He's come off some big victories, but he's tired. He is weary. But he knows the right thing to do is to get the Amalekites out of Israel. He knows if he doesn't finish the job, it's not going to be good. Okay. And yet, now after this, he's going to come along a couple groups of people that are turds. Yeah, Derek. Do you have a question? Nope. All right. Verse 5. Somebody pick up there. So his men now on the east side of the Jordan, they're pursuing the Midianites, specifically their two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. And he asks his countrymen, okay, the Sukkotes, the town of Sukkot, right? I need bread. Feed my people. Feed your people. Okay, we're all on the same team here, okay? Because we're exhausted. We need food. This is the response, verse 6. What does that mean? Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna, these foreign enemies, these foreign kings, are their hands already in your hands? Have you already captured them that we should give you food? Yeah, get the job done first and then maybe we'll feed you, right? Why would they say that? The Midianites are from east. They came from the east, okay? Now, Israel's on the east side of the Jordan. If the Midianites win this battle, who's the first group of people that get oppressed when they come back into Israel? The people on the east side of the Jordan, which is where these guys live. So they're saying, hey, we're not going to take sides. We're not idiots. We're going to be Switzerland here. Get the job done. Win the battle. And if you're the victors, come back for some bread. If you're not, see ya, right? How do you think Gideon's going to respond to that? Not so favorably, okay? So He says, all right, when the Lord had given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hands, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness with briars. I'm going to come back. I'm going to put all your hands on the chalkboard. I'm going to drop your pants down, and I'm going to whip you with briars. I'm going to treat you like a three-year-old, okay? I'm going to whoop you because you didn't take care of your people in this army. I'm going to embarrass you, is what he's saying. I will thrash you with briars, okay? He went up from there to Penuel. Penuel is where Jacob had his interaction with God on the east side of the Jordan. So another town right next to Sukkot makes the same request. Please feed us. We're hungry. And they answered him just as the men of Sukkot answered. No. Go in the battle. Come back. Maybe we'll feed you then. But right now, we're going to remain uncommitted. Okay? Absolutely not. And he says, yeah, you want some of that? I'll give you some of that. So when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. I'm going to wreck shop in your town. So that's how you want to play? Fine. So again, you can see this tension between the east side and the west side already. Okay? Now, verse 10. Let's pick up the story there. That's insane. 300 versus 120,000. And 120,000 lose. Yay, God. Keep going.
And Gideon went up by the way of the ten dwellers east of Nobah and Shobeah and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic.
So Gideon's like, all right, we don't need bread, we don't need water, let's go. Let's go fight. They do it. They pursue these two kings. They win the battle. Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle, comes back down to Sukkot in verse 14. He captured a youth, makes him kind of give up some information. The youth wrote down to him all the princes of the elders, 77 men. He says, tell me the leaders of your town. Write them down. I want the name of every leader of this town. Okay? And he came to the men of Sukkot in verse 15 and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna concerning whom you taunted me, meaning are the heads of Zalmunna and Zalmunna in your hands, meaning, oh, these guys here that I just beat in battle, are these the guys you were asking about earlier, whether their heads were in my hands? Oh, look, they are, or hands in my hands. I defeated them. He took the elders of the city and thorns in the wilderness and briars, disciplined the men of Sukkot with them. So he spanks them, okay, literally spanks them. 15, or 17 rather, he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. So he told the guys of Penuel, you won't feed us, I'm going to tear down your altar, and he killed the men of the city. These are his countrymen on the east side of the Jordan River, okay? Verse 18 now, he says to Zeba and Zalmunna, the foreign kings who he's just done battle with, what kind of men were they who you killed at Tabor? Mount Tabor is in the Jezreel Valley where these guys originally set up shop to do battle. And apparently as they came in, they killed some of Gideon's countrymen in his tribe. Okay, and Gideon asked them, what kind of men were they? Meaning, who were they? Who were the guys that you killed? And this is the answer they get in verse 18. End of verse 18.
Men like you. Each one with the bearing of a prince.
What does that mean? What are they saying?
They have a son. They think he's the king.
They're kissing his backside right now, right? They were just like you, Gideon, sons of a king. Noble, right? They were a big deal. So they're hoping by placating to Gideon's pride, saying, man, you're like the son of a king. You're a really big deal, Gideon, that they're going to be showing some grace here. Okay, that's not at all what Gideon gives him. Verse 19, Jimmy, keep rolling.
Gideon replied, those were my brothers, the sons of my own mother. As surely as the Lord lives, if you had spared their lives, I would not kill you.
Those are my people, those are my countrymen, the sons of my mother. Had you let them live, I wouldn't kill you. But now, because of your actions, I'm going to kill you. So, he tells his firstborn son, kill them. Verse 20, the youth did not draw a sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. Zeba and Zalmunna in verse 21 mock him and say, rise up yourself, fall on us, for you as the man, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on the camel's neck. So he kills the kings and takes the the jewelry that they would have adorned their camels with. Okay, and this gets really weird here. This is an odd ending to the story, so you guys can interpret this, and we'll kind of see where we land. But it's an unfortunate ending to otherwise what is a great story of Gideon. Okay, 22 now. Battle's been won. He's back in his hometown, and the men of Israel now come to Gideon in verse 22 and ask him this.
Rule over us, both you and your son, and also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.
What's the offer here?
Be our king.
Be our king, not our judge, right? What are they offering him here specifically? You, your son, and your son's sons. What's that called? It's called a dynasty, a monarchy. Yeah, like Gideon, you're going to be the first of many from your family. Be our king. This is different, right? We've seen a lot of judges, but the judges are people that are raised up by God. They reign for a season, then they go away. But there is no succession plan, right? They're saying, Gideon, be our king. Now, where did they get this idea of a king? They've seen it from all the other nations around them. We want a king. We want to have guys like Zeb and Zalmunna and Sihon and Og, big, strong, tough guys that are leaders. And Gideon, you're our guy. Let's start a dynasty now. Is that a pretty sweet offer? Really sweet offer. And if you are not humble and think a whole lot of yourself, man, that is a pretty tempting offer to say yes to. Okay, Gideon in verse 23, this is his answer, Jordan.
I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.
How you like that? Absolutely. Like, I am not going to be your king. God's going to be your king. That's what God wants, right? He doesn't want a king. He wants to rule. He is your king, okay? Great response, and then you get 24. It's just like, Gideon says to them, I would request, however, that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. So all the stuff that you stole from the Midianites, give me a piece of it, okay? 25, they say, no problem. They give him this these earrings. 26, the weight of the earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments that he had taken off the camels. And in verse 27, Gideon made all these gold pieces into an ephod, and they placed it in his city, Orpha. What is an ephod? You've heard the name before. Very good, okay. An ephod is a garment that the high priest would have worn. Now, we're not sure if this is, like, it's odd that he would make a bathrobe out of gold, but maybe he did, or maybe it's some type of, like, something, right? It's something visible, it's some type of idol potentially, or maybe it's a, we don't know what Gideon's intentions were, the problem. So why did he make a linen ephod? Was it to honor the priestly line? Was he going to give that to Levi? I have no idea. But he makes this linen ephod, or this golden ephod, and what does Israel do in verse 27? They worship it. They bow down and worship this idol that Gideon makes. It's like, wait, you just said God's going to be your king, and then you make an idol that the people worship. Like, Gideon, was that your intent the whole time? Like, is this jacked up spirituality time of, yeah, we're going to worship God, and then a little bit everybody else too? Or did Gideon, was he making an altar that the people mistook for an idol and they worshiped it? We don't know, right? The story of Gideon seems to be like so flawless in his heart and everything. At the end of it, like, this is what we're left with. And it's a really unfortunate ending of the story. So,
is that just because of the people's hearts? Like, you know, it's like he created something that was just meant for something else, but it's like kind of like not his fault that the people took it.
Yeah. I think that's a valid interpretation. I think it could be. I think what also could be is Gideon was influenced just like everybody else by the people of the land, and maybe compromised a little bit at the end of his life, right? By the way, when do you tend to compromise in life? At the end. When you see compromise happen a lot in the scriptures, and we'll see it with some kings coming up in the book of Kings and other people, it's at the end. It's when you have success. It's when you're wealthy. You have prosperity. You've climbed the ladder. Life is good. It's not during times of difficulty as much. Not to say that never happens, but it's at the end. So I don't know if Gideon just got lax. I don't know if Gideon really was fully like committed to God to the end, and they literally mistook that. But man, it's just an unfortunate deal. So Literally at the end of verse 27, it says that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. It becomes a problem, right, to all of Israel. However, 28, Midian was subdued. They did not lift their heads up anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So God allows Gideon to rule as a judge, not as a king, for 40 days, or for 40 years, rather. So Joseph mentioned earlier, it was 7 years they were oppressed by the Midianites, and then God comes in and saves the day in 40 years now of peace that they have. But this thing that he makes is a bad deal. Now, here's some other things that would maybe lead you down the path of maybe Gideon, actually, that's exactly what he meant. Read 29.
Son of Joash went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives.
70 sons, okay? He also, verse 31, has a concubine who was in Shechem and bore him a son. His name was Abimelech, okay? He is going to be the next judge, Abimelech. He is a dirty turd. He is awful. One of the sons of Gideon, okay? So he's got a gazillion wives, he's got concubines, and he's got 70 sons as a result of this. So is Gideon's morality a little bit confused? And that's Judges, right? It's a period of confused spirituality. It's weird. So I don't know how to take Gideon. I mean, I hate that like the last mark on his life ends like this, okay? Gideon, the son of Joash, died, verse 32, at a ripe old age, was buried in the tomb, his father, Ophrah, and the Abiezrites. Like, good for you. So you die, you saved Israel, you rule for 40 years, but you've got this big question mark at the end of your reign, okay? Now, his awful son, 33, is going to have some ideas coming, okay? But watch what happens to Israel as soon as Gideon dies, 33. Okay, this is particularly awful, by the way, in your text, the way it reads. They whored after the Baals, and they made Baal Berith their god. We haven't seen this specific iteration of Baal. What? Anybody got a note on what Baal Berith means? Or Berit, that word? It means covenant. The Lord of the Covenant.
Like covenant agreement, or...
Alright.
Why would that bother God? He's the God of the covenant, right? He has made them the covenant. Like, that is offensive to God that they would enter into a covenant with another false idol. But that's the God that they worship. So again, do you see these cycles? But they're downward spiral cycles. By the time we get to Gideon, man, they've got new gods. Chapter 9, we're going to see. Is it 9? 10. Some new gods that they bring into the arena of worship, if you will. So it goes bad in a hurry. Okay, Baal Berith, the God, Lord of the Covenant, is literally what that means. So, rough. Yeah, Julian.
I guess I'm having a little bit of a hard time kind of like... like, you have a piece of wood, you talk to it, it literally does not talk back, and it's like, you want to make a covenant? Okay, cool.
I'm with you. Well, here's the temptation, and I think it's multifaceted. One, on a pure carnal level, we talked about how they worship, right? How these worship services would have been with Baal and Asherah and the temple prostitution. So as a pure carnal thing, that would have been a temptation for Israel to enter into that just for the satisfaction of their own flesh, okay? Secondly, God provided for them in the wilderness, right? 40 years manna, but he wasn't this lavish, abundant God. He was the God of the just enough. He provided for them and gave them what they needed, but that was it. Now they're going into a land that the people that they don't know and gods that they don't worship, and they need grapes to grow. Is God a God of grapes? No, he's a God of the wilderness. Is God a God of the harvest? No, he's a God of the wilderness. He's the God that gets you out of Egypt and parts the Red Sea, which is all well and good. Like, we're not going to take away from that. That's good, okay? We're not punning you completely, God, but this isn't your territory. The problem is, what do we need? We need rain, we need harvest, we need barley to grow, we need harvest to come, and the people in the land say, do you want that here? Do you want to eat? Do you want to feed your kids? then these are the gods of the land that you need to worship for that to happen. Keep your God, that's all well and good. Put them on the mantle alongside our gods as well. So it's not just a G.I. Joe action figure that you talk to and doesn't talk back. It's this is the representation of a God that lives in heaven. You're going to worship it, and he's in charge of the harvest. He brings the rain, not your God. So do you see the temptation? It's real life. You want to pay the rent? Yep. Then worship my God. Huh. I happen to be broke right now. Okay. You know what I mean? That is the very real honest temptation in these people's lives. So when you start putting in those type of terms, you go, got it. I think I would have worshipped Baal too.
Is it fair to, when I read the story of Gideon, like you see where, when we first meet him, he's the least of the least, and he knows his hands to face.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks really humble. But as we go on, you know, he even in killing Zebah and Zalmunna out of really pride, they offend him. And he kills them out of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And then allowing his men to sort of worship him and make him king.
Yeah.
You see almost this sort of like arrogance.
Yeah.
Is that fair? A fair observation to make?
He may have just gotten too big for his britches, as we say in Texas. I think that's quite possible. And I think sometimes we get these Sunday school pictures of people that are just jacked. Like, you read Samson's life. Samson's a hero in Sunday school. Samson's a nightmare. He is a moral... I like him. I mean, he has some... Yeah, but we forget, David's a murdering adulterer. Let's not forget that in a story, right? There's things to like. Samson's... Does God use him? Yeah, but he uses him in spite of Samson. Samson is a prideful, arrogant... imbecile, right? And yet he gets used by God, right? And I think a lot of ways God says, yeah, and I can still use prideful, arrogant imbeciles to get my work done, right? So thank God. So I wonder if this is just one of those that we've kind of seen through these rose-colored glasses of Gideon and like, oh, he's so good and fleeces and, you know, it's all, but we forget to go, you know what? No, he actually led the country into idolatry that he had just led out of idolatry. So, or maybe not. Like, there's still room there to say, maybe not. But is there some pride there? Yeah. Is there some compromise in the age of marriage and morality? Absolutely. So does that fit? Absolutely. So, I don't know. So, I may have to apologize to Gideon when I get there. But Nehemiah.
Yeah, my boy.
No, there's obviously plenty of good ones, but there's ones like these that are tough. Now, this, again, it's just a dark day, and the dimmer switch that is Israel is continuing to get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer in terms of the spiritual light that is in the country, and by chapter 10, man, it's dang near off. I mean, it's just bad, okay? Now, Abimelech, Gideon's son, he sees an absence of leadership. He is not anything like his dad, at least when he started, and he says, man, that spot is mine, okay? What's the problem? If your dad got offered a dynasty and he turned it down, and now you've got a desire to be king and you're Abimelech, what's your problem? How many sons does Gideon have? 70. And if you want to be king, what's your problem? I got to deal with 69 or 70, whatever, brothers that also either are vying for that spot or I've got to do something about it. That's the guy we're about to meet, Abimelech. Okay. Don't name your kids Abimelech. Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, verse 9, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives. This is the people on the east side of the Jordan that were, to Shechem, wrong town, west side of the Jordan, okay, his mother's relatives in his hometown, and basically says to them in verse 2, which is better for you, 70 men that all of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or one man rule over you? You want 70 kings? Because that's what you're about to get. Or do you want one? And they said, you know what? We're bone of your bone, flesh of your flesh. How about you rule over us? And they said to him, basically, man in verse 3, that's our boy. Abimelech is our relative. So, one king would be better. And if you want to be that guy, then great. Okay? Verse 4, the men of Shechem, the town of Shechem, okay, gives them, gives specifically Abimelech, 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-Berit, okay, this god, new god that they're worshiping, which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men to follow him. So he's such a turd, he can't even get guys to follow him. He has to pay people to be in his posse. Okay? Verse 5. Here's what he does, because he's a turd. Joe, read that.
He went to his father's home in Ophrah, and one on one stone murdered him, his 70 brothers and the sons of Jeroboam. But Jonathan, the youngest son of Jeroboam, escaped by hiding.
What a turd. He kills, he murders 70 of his brothers on the same stone. Murders them, dead. One brother, Jotham, the youngest son, somehow escapes murder and flees, okay? And then he shows up. This guy's bizarre, right? Whether he was a baby or whatever, all the men in verse 6, by the way, of Shechem gathered together at Shechem, and they made Abimelech king. So here's the new king on the block. Everybody else is dead. That's our only option. Abimelech's now king, and now the youngest brother youngest son of Gideon now, and Abimelech's brother Jotham comes and gives this prophetic voice and says, okay, I know what's gone on. I survived. Here's what's going to happen. And he tells this story. So this guy's like a poet, okay? Troy, you're our best poet in here. Pick up in verse 7. Read this.
When it was told to Jonathan, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint the king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go hold sway over the trees?
So he likens Abimelech to a tree, okay? Or these men requesting of a tree. And he starts with the olive tree. Anybody know anything about an olive tree in Israel? They're awesome, they're respected, they're great trees. So you went to the olive tree and said, be our king. And the olive tree's response to you was what? Man, I got time for you. I'm not going to leave the fatness of my land, all the abundance that I have to be your king. Meaning, that job is beneath me. Okay? Keep rolling, Troy.
But the fig tree said to them, and the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?
So basically, the fig tree... the olive, the fig, and the vine, the grape, all reject him. So it's the idea that you're going from greatest to, okay, well, we'll take our second pick. Okay, they said no as well. Well, then maybe we'll take our third pick. Oh, gosh, they said no as well, right? You see where Jotham's going here? And then, verse 14, keep rolling.
Then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us.
The bramble, right? This is like West Texas weeds, right? We'll take whatever we get. We'll go to the bramble, i.e. Abimelech. You come reign over us. Verse 15, keep rolling.
And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come, take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon.
So he's like, man, if come be my king, I'll be your king if that's what you want. Come take refuge in my shade. But if you're jacking with me, then I'm going to set all y'all on fire. Okay, so Jotham is making a pretty clear statement about what he thinks about Abimelech. Like, you guys picked a worthless piece of garbage to be your king, and you're going to get exactly what you deserve for making him king. You are culpable for this, okay? And he says to them in verse 16, if you have dealt in truth and integrity, making Abimelech king, meaning if this was a good call, and if you have dwelt well with Jeroboam and his house, if you have honored Gideon, his dad, in this, then great. I mean, this is all going to be good, okay? This is going to be a good deal for you. However, verse 18, if you have risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and made his turd McFerguson son the king, then how dare you, it says in the text, if you, in verse 19, have dealt with truth and integrity with Jeroboam in his own house, rejoice and let him be your king. Okay? But, verse 20, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and consume Abimelech. Meaning, this is going to be a volatile relationship. He's going to burn you down and you're going to burn him down if this was done in disregard. Okay? So this is the prophetic voice of Jotham. Okay? If this was good and Abimelech's really a stand-up guy, you're all good. If not, this is going to be the undoing of you, you're going to undo him, and he's going to undo you. And this is going to be a disaster, okay? By the way, the rest of chapter 9 is this undoing, okay? Jotham's voice was indeed prophetic, and the fire that Jotham says is going to come is all of the rest of chapter 9, okay? So we'll read bits and pieces of it here, but it's a disaster. And because this is a prophetic voice, literally, from the Lord, it comes to be the case, okay? So now somehow in verse 21, 9:21, Jotham escapes and fled and went to Beer. And I guess that's what you do when 7 of your sons die. You go to Beer, okay? By the way, anybody know what Beer means? Remember? The well, okay? So he goes to the well. How about that? So he goes back to his hometown and escapes. I know. I'm not. I didn't name the church, man. I just work here. I just work at Beer. So Abimelech now reigns over Israel for 3 years. So he is allowed now a period of grace, and then what Jotham promises will happen, because this is a bad deal, it's going to go south in a hurry. Okay. Let's see. Now, verse 26, fast forward to there. We're in the town of Shechem, and Gaal, this guy that we meet, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their trust in him. So Gaal is going to lead a coup against Abimelech. Okay, he doesn't like him because of the type of guy that he is. There's this guy by the name of Zebal that he partners with. 28, Gaal, the son of Ebed, said to Abimelech, in it, who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is not the son of Jerubbaal, and is Zeal not his lieutenant? Zebal is Abimelech's like right hand man in this battle. Okay, so he is trying Gaal to overthrow Abimelech. Zebal, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal. Gaal is the guy leading the coup. Zebal is the guy in the city that's ruling the city currently on Abimelech's behalf. 31, he sends messengers to Abimelech deceitfully, and Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives had come to Shechem, said, behold, they are going to stir up the city against you. So Abimelech gets word that there's a coup coming down. He's going to try to stop it, but it's not going to go well for him. Let's see. I'm trying to summarize this long story for you, because there's lots of people and words, and it gets quite confusing. Okay, verse 39, somebody pick up there. Okay. Gaal chases this guy. Gaal is the guy that wants the coup. Okay. Abimelech remained at Armunah. Zebal drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. Zebal is his army lieutenant, but he changes basically sides in the midst of this battle and sides with Gaal, traps Abimelech. Okay. Abimelech now, in verse 45, traps Gaal and his men, and watch what he does in verse 45. This is Shechem. What did Jotham say would happen if the men of Shechem had done a dishonor by putting Gideon's son in leadership? They were going to set each other on fire. What does Gideon do to the city? He just set it on fire. He raised it and sowed the city with salt, meaning he set it on fire and then put salt on it. It's the idea that it's like Sodom and Gomorrah. It is a heaping wasteland now. Okay, so part of this prophecy has come true. Shechem, you turned on Abimelech midway through his rule. You followed Gaal, this guy that wanted to start a coup. And now Abimelech won the battle. He put down the coup, and he set your city on fire. Okay, all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem heard of it. They ran now to the inner chamber in verse 46 at the temple of El-Berith, this Baal-Berith guy that we were reading about earlier, that god. They set up shop in this tower, and then watch what, this is dirty, by the way. There's 1,000 men that take sanctuary in a chamber inside this city. In 49, all the people cut down a branch, just like Abimelech had done, and set the inner chamber on fire over the house. So they literally put these guys that are hiding now in a tomb, set their tower on fire, and burn them while they're in there. That's dirty. I mean, you're getting a lot to know about the character of this guy. This is Gideon's son, right? Like, he's a far cry from Gideon, at least how he started, okay? So, horrible, horrible ending. And then Abimelech now is going to go to Thebez, which is a town about 10 miles from Shechem, to go deal with it, because it had joined in this rebellion as well. 51, there was a strong tower in the center of the city. All the men and women and the leaders fled there and shut themselves in, and they went upon the roof of that tower. What do you think Abimelech's going to do now? He's going to set that thing on fire as well, just like he did in Shechem. However, look who comes and saves the day. Sarah, read 52 and 53.
So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his...
Yes! So they're trapped in this tower, and this woman drops a rock off the tower, a millstone, and hits Gideon or Abimelech in the head, and mortally wounds him. Doesn't kill him, but mortally wounds him. So this woman saves the day. It's great, right? They were going to all get set on fire. Verse 54, keep reading.
Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through and he died.
I mean, how much pride do you have when you're like, man, just run me through because I can't let my name go down in history that a woman killed me. Like, you dirty, okay?
He's still in there. I would have brought a girl out there just to kill him.
And then it does, right? Sorry, we're a little bit over. Summing up the story, verse 56, God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in the killing of his 70 brothers. So Shechem gets set on fire. Abimelech gets set on fire. It's a wreck. Jotham's prophecy comes true. Abimelech's now dead, the son of Gideon, and his leadership is bad, bad, bad. Okay, so this is the condition of the judges, unfortunately, in Israel during this day. All right, so good day to you guys. We'll see you tomorrow. Pick up on some more judges.
We're going to see Sam from